Welcome back. Cleaning Windows, Van the Man, the Bard from Belfast. When we come back, Joseph Laycock. He teaches a class called Demonology, Possession, and Exorcism. And he'll talk about why we are living in the golden era of exorcism. It's more popular than ever. Back with Joseph Laycock as we discuss spirit possession right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you from Coast's Toronto affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. Joseph Laycock teaches a class called Demonology, Possession, and Exorcism. And he is the editor of Spirit Possession Around the World, Possession, Communion, and Demon Expulsion Across Cultures. Joseph Laycock, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, I've listened to Coast AM since I was a teenager back in the Art Bell days, and I never imagined I would actually be on it. This is like being on the cover of a Rolling Stone, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we're delighted that you would join us. I was, I don't know, I would say I was surprised, but this poll that came out in 2012, 57% of Americans believe in demonic possession. What do you think of that poll? Was that shocking to you, or based on your research and your understanding of the field? I mean, does that make sense?
Well, that poll was taken by Public Policy on October 30th, so it's possible that if it weren't right around Halloween, it might have been a little bit lower, but that's pretty much consistent with other polls. The Baylor Religion Survey, done at Baylor University here in Texas back in 2007, found 48% of Americans believe in demonic possession, and that same year, Pew Forum asked if Americans believe in demons and angels, and that was higher. That was 68%. So that's not far off. That's more or less consistent.
Now, how about for you? Here you are. You teach an honors course at Texas State University, pretty prestigious institution, and you're teaching a course in demonology and possession and exorcism. How do you approach this course? Are you looking at it as a sociological phenomenon, or are you a believer?
Well, this is really important because we're a state institution, so I work for the government, and the Constitution is pretty clear. The government cannot tell you what you ought to believe. So I'm always very careful that we're discussing what other people believe, but I'm not telling my students to believe in demons or to believe in one particular religion's perspective about what demons are. And I also don't think it's my job to attack students who believe in the supernatural, right? That's kind of up to them. So we do a variety of different approaches, historical, anthropological, sociological. We even read some psychiatric literature. And what I'm really training the students to do is to think about complex problems from a lot of different angles and positions. And that's a skill that will help them with a lot of other things besides just thinking about demons and possession. Those are skills that will help them on the job market also.
But still, you were attracted, obviously, to this field. What was it that led you into wanting to teach a course?
Well, you know, I think this is an inherently interesting topic, right? I mean, we've seen this surge of movies like The Conjuring dealing with the demonic. I think for me, this sort of path really began when I was doing my doctoral studies at Boston University. I took a course taught by a history professor named John Roberts, and he's a professor of the history of ideas. So he studies both religious and scientific ideas. And in the course, he had us read William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist. And I said, why are we reading this? This is a novel. This isn't history. This isn't a true story. But as some listeners probably know, The Exorcist is based on a true story. And more than that, reading it, you get a sense of what it was like for Catholics like William Peter Blatty living in America in the 1970s, where they really wanted to believe in the supernatural, but they wanted some sort of direct confrontation like you see in that story. And so I wrote a term paper, and I learned more about William Peter Blatty and more about the case that this was based on, and I eventually ended up publishing that paper as an academic journal. And then when ABC Clio asked me if I would edit an entire encyclopedia about spirit possession around the world, that sent me on a search to go find people who are specialists in all sorts of cultures, people who have traveled in Tibet and seen mediums in Tibet become possessed, and people who research Algonquin legends of the Wendigo, who possesses people and makes them turn into cannibals and eat other people. So it's really been a fascinating journey exploring all this stuff. And part of what I do in the class is I share some of that excitement with the students, and I think they had a good time.
Now, I'm going to try to pin you down here, Joseph, because you skillfully avoided answering my question about whether you believe, let's start with sort of a more of a general question. Do you believe in the existence of, let's say, a spirit world or an unseen world?
You know, I think that depends on the day, to be totally honest. When I'm sort of sitting in my office and I'm deep in kind of academic mode and focusing on things you can prove, that usually it doesn't weigh on my mind very much, the spirit world. Although right now I'm sitting in my office and it's 1 a.m. and the whole office is empty and dark. So at times like this, I'm far more inclined to believe that there is a spirit world. So I think that beliefs are not something that we just have or we don't have, like a social security number. I think these are kinds of living things that sort of wax and wane. So I'm sorry I keep giving you slippery answers, but this is an important issue in religious study, right? Is what do we, how do we imagine people's beliefs work? So I guess the short answer to your question would be often, but not always. Yeah, I think there could be a spirit world out there.
All right. Are you familiar with Dr. Richard Gallagher? He's a state-certified psychiatrist in the state of New York. And a number of years ago, he published an article. Mind you, it was in a Catholic a publication. I believe it was the Catholic Observer, in which he documented what he genuinely believed was, and again, this is a state-certified psychiatrist. He documented a case of what he called an authentic case of demonic possession. Are you familiar with that case at all?
I'm not particularly familiar with Gallagher, but there's plenty of cases like that where there is some really fascinating evidence that I think it would be a mistake to simply explain away. Yeah.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to travel down to Yonkers, New York, and I met with him. And again, you know, it's one thing to theorize about it, but when you're face to face with a man of science, presumably, you know, and he talks to you with great conviction about having witnessed some pretty remarkable things in this particular patient, who was able to tell him things about his personal life there was no way she would have known, was able to. During a conversation, he had a private telephone conversation with a Catholic priest who was in a remote location. They were speaking by phone. All of a sudden, this voice came on the phone and was talking about them. This apparently was this entity. I mean, I got to tell you, I was chilled by that. Have you had any experiences like that in speaking with people that had similar encounters that just left you rattled?
I am unfortunately more sort of an ivory tower academic. I would love to get out there and actually witness an exorcism or something of that sort. I have been to Point Pleasant, West Virginia a few times, which is something that a place that your listeners may be familiar with the Mothman sightings in the 1960s and the Silver Bridge collapse. And I talked to people there who had seen some of the paranormal activity going on in the town at the time. And it's really true. If you talk to someone who's had that kind of experience, it really is much more difficult to simply laugh off what they're talking about as hallucination or a hoax or something like this. It really does make you think that something very profound happened to them. Now, exactly what that was, I think it's very hard to approach that in kind of a rational or a scientific way. But I think there's a really important point here, which is that we should not be smug when we confront people who have had these types of experiences, right? If we weren't there, it's not our place to sort of dismiss them, because it's not a joke when it happens to you.
In this article that you wrote, you talk about whether or not we're living in the golden era of exorcism. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, exorcism, of course, has gone on basically throughout all of human history, right? We have documents from ancient Egypt and Babylon and India describing what someone is like when they are possessed by a spirit or a god or a demon, and various practices to get rid of that. And, of course, in the Gospels, Jesus and his apostles can perform exorcisms, and this went on through the Middle Ages. But exorcism really became an enormous epidemic sort of proportions in the 16th and 17th centuries after the Protestant Reformation, when you had wars in Europe between Protestants and Catholics, and you had different churches trying to prove that they had the power to cast demons out, and this is how you knew that they were a true church. What happened next, though, after the Enlightenment, right, which is sort of the rise of the scientific revolution, and then finally in the 19th century, the beginning of psychiatry, is people began to say, well, you know, these people, when they go into convulsions and they speak in voices and things like this, this is actually just a medical problem. Nothing supernatural is happening here. And people who believe this is something supernatural are just, you know, kind of not, they're not enlightened the way that we are. They're sort of backwards. And this became kind of the predominant view of exorcism, at least in sort of the mainstream media for a long time. So in the United States, churches like the Catholic Church, who have always had exorcism as a rite of the church, tried to kind of keep this on the down low, right? Catholics are a minority in America, and they didn't want to be accused of being superstitious immigrants. And there was sort of a popular consensus up until the 70s that exorcism is something that kind of happened in the Dark Ages. It doesn't really happen anymore. It's not something that's supposed to go on in proper religions and proper churches. And one thing that William Peter Blatty's novel did, and of course the movie that came after, was it showed that people really take the idea of demons and exorcism very seriously. For a lot of people, it's not a laughing matter. It's an important belief to them. And so I think what the church has realized is that instead of something to be embarrassed of, the ability to protect people from supernatural evil and to perform exorcisms is actually an asset for the church. It's something that can attract people to the church. And so the Catholic Church has begun to train more exorcists. They've become more friendly towards priests who are interested in exorcism. And meanwhile, in Protestant churches, there has been a huge resurgence of what a lot of Protestants would call deliverance ministries, where they say they can cast out demons. And there are even people like Bob Larson, who is an exorcist, who will exorcise you over Skype for a small fee.
Yes.
It's become very, very controversial. So exorcism is big business once again. So there's a number of reasons for that, but this is a great time to be studying exorcism and to be studying people's beliefs about demons.
Well, why the resurgence? You mentioned the Catholic Church, and of course there was a very celebrated case of Pope John Paul II performing an exorcism, kind of a spontaneous exorcism in St. Peter's. In the Vatican, when a woman supposedly who was possessed came towards him and he performed this exorcism. Now, was that kind of a calculated a move, or do you think the pontiff was in fact genuine in believing that this person was possessed?
Well, you know, this is, you know, if you're a pope, this is a very precarious political position, because you're trying to speak for a church with millions of people who don't always see eye to eye on the same thing. And actually, Catholics are very divided over things like exorcism. You know, when The Exorcist came out, a Jesuit magazine, and of course, Father Karras, the character in the novel, is a Jesuit, said, this is a terrible book, this makes our religion look silly, they called it pornography. But other priests said, this is wonderful, I'm glad someone is finally talking about the reality of evil and the reality of the devil. And in 1990, There was even a service in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York where someone read from The Exorcist. So if you're the Pope, you're in this awkward position because half of your followers, right, really think exorcism is important and should be done publicly and without being embarrassed. And the other half see it as something from the Dark Ages, right, that sort of sophisticated modern people shouldn't be involved in. And so I think popes like John Paul II and Pope Francis has also done something like this, are very crafty in doing these what appear to be exorcisms in public, but then they also have a kind of plausible deniability, right? They can say, well, it wasn't really an exorcism, it was a blessing. And if the person sort of slumped over and appeared to thrash a little bit while they received that blessing, it was probably just because it was such an emotional experience. Do they actually think of themselves as casting out demons? You know, it's quite possible that they do. But then again, you have to think about what does the Pope actually consider a demon to be? Is it sort of a negative impulse that we all have, or is it something really very literally spiritually evil that kind of clings to people? So I've been giving you some cagey answers about my beliefs, and I think if I were a Pope, I could be even cagier and never letting you know what I really think.
But there is a chief exorcist in the Vatican, is there not?
Yeah, every Catholic diocese is supposed to have an exorcist, and in a lot of cases, especially back in the 70s, the person who was sort of on paper as being the exorcist had never done an exorcism and may not have even believed in exorcism. Rome is a diocese, and so there is an exorcist of Rome. I believe that's still Gabriel Amorth, who's very old and associated with the International Association of Exorcism. And he does hundreds of exorcisms a year, he said in interviews, some even over the phone. So there is a big demand for exorcism, and I think the Catholic Church has realized that they have to meet that demand, right? There's a free market of churches and free market of religions, and this is a service that they need to offer so that they can maintain market share. So yeah, exorcism is is one of many, many services that the Catholic Church can offer to stay relevant.
Maintaining market share, that's an interesting way of looking at it. If you were attending divinity school at Princeton, for example, would they be teaching exorcism?
Well, I don't know about Princeton. I went to divinity school at Harvard. But no, there was not really much discussion there of the demonic or really anything that smacked of superstition. And this is something that's being debated right now in religious studies, is that for a long time religious studies has emphasized that religion is really about ethics, right? Which of course it is. Religion is very much about values and how you ought to treat people. But things like exorcism or possession or miracles or healing or apparitions of the Virgin Mary, this was all regarded as sort of embarrassing for a very long time. And this is partly
all right.
Because
Joseph, got to cut in here. We'll take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue to delve into spirit possession around the world. Joseph P. Laycock, my guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Theology professor Joseph Laycock is here, and he'll present more of why exorcisms remain so popular right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Joseph Laycock teaches an honors course at Texas State University called Demonology, Possession, and Exorcism. How popular is this course, Joseph?
It's very popular. We don't offer it all the time. So this was the first time they let me teach it, and this is partly to create greater awareness of what religious studies is and the kinds of courses that you can take in it. But there was a lottery to be in the course, so we filled up pretty quickly.
And the students that come to this course, I don't know if you have a handle on this, but in terms of percentages, what percentage are there because they're just curious? What percentage are firm believers in, for example, demonic possession? And what percentage perhaps are hardened debunkers or skeptics?
I don't think I had any students this time around that were hardened debunkers or skeptics. I do get those sometimes in my classes. They had a healthy skepticism for some of the claims that we looked at, because just because demons are real doesn't mean, or doesn't, if you believe demons are real, it doesn't mean every case of alleged demonic possession is real. A lot of them were from Texas, from small towns in Texas where people believed in demons, and their churches would hold deliverance ministries or ceremonies to cast out demons. One person, when we watched the video of the exorcism in the Starbucks, even said, "You know, I knew people in my church youth group, high schoolers, who would cast out demons," and it looked a lot like that. So it was a diverse group of students, but definitely some of the Central Texas culture, religious culture, was definitely present in the classroom as well.
Do you ever discuss, from a, I guess a sociological aspect, about whether or not a belief in demonic possession is a dangerous thing? Because there have been a number, just about every year, we get cases of people actually dying during some sort of an exorcism.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this happens all the time. Just today, there was a report out of South Africa where four women were sentenced for a crime in 2012 in which they disemboweled a 14-year-old girl. And they said, "We were trying to pull a demon out of her. We were trying to save her." So if you try to sort of do exorcism, you know, do it yourself, and you don't know what you're doing, unfortunately, there are many, many cases where people have been killed in this fashion. And so one thing that churches do is they set out ground rules, right, that if we're going to do this, we need to, you know, it needs to be done in a certain way. Ideally, there should be a doctor present and this sort of thing. So I could see an atheist coming in and saying the belief itself is the problem. These poor people would still be alive if no one believed in demons, if we just accepted that this was a superstition. But I'm not sure that that argument really gets us anywhere, because people have believed in demons and exorcism for all of human history. So it's not like we have the option of just controlling what people will do with their religion.
And what about cross-culturally or across various religions? My background is Christian, so I'm well familiar with, you know, the Christian and the Protestant views on demonic possession and so forth. I know far less about Muslims or the Judaic approach to demonic possession. What can you tell me about other religions and exorcisms, for example?
Well, one of the most interesting things about possession is that it occurs in almost every culture. Almost every culture on earth believes that it's possible for something that isn't you to get inside of you and affect the way that you act and talk. And in some cultures, this can be a good thing, right? So it could be if you are kind of having a fit and you're saying strange things, that this could mean in some cultures that you're going to become a shaman, someone who can be a healer or a prophet who can deliver messages from the gods. In Christianity, this is almost always bad. This is almost always a demon. The only exception would be things like Pentecostal churches, where people could describe, you know, becoming filled with the Holy Spirit, and they wouldn't speak of that as possession, but it's still being inhabited by a spirit. In Islam, there is a tradition of creatures called the jinn, and the jinn in Islam are not angels, and they're not people. They're a third order of being that God created from fire. And unlike demons in the Christian tradition, jinn have free will, and they can decide if they want to be good and they want to help humans, or if they want to be evil and do bad things. And some Muslims say that the jinn cannot actually possess you, right? The chief of the jinn is sort of the Satan in the Quran. His name is Iblis, and he's described as a whisperer. So he tempts you to do things that you shouldn't do. And some Muslims say that, you know, the jinn and Iblis, they can't literally make you do things. They can't possess you. They can't take over your body. They can only whisper. But lots of people in the Muslim world believe you can get possessed by jinn, and they have forms of exorcism to get rid of them. And so there are many different techniques for this, because there's Muslims all over the world, and they all have sort of different folk techniques. But you can now go into places in London, for instance, where there is a large Muslim population, and you can see a sheikh who will do tests on you to see if you have a jinn, and then if he finds that you have one, we'll try to get rid of it for you. In Judaism, there are creatures called the dibbuk, and the dibbuk is usually assumed to be not a demon, but a spirit of the dead. One of the great people I got to meet while researching this book was Jason Haxton, who wrote a book called The Dybbuk Box, which was eventually made into a film. And the Dybbuk can be evil. They can make you do unusual behavior, but they can also be a kind of sympathetic figure. These are lost souls that need our help, and they're only possessing people because they don't know what else to do. They can't go on into the afterlife like they're supposed to. So in Christianity, possession is always pretty bad. In other cultures, it can be bad, but it doesn't have to be quite as demonic as it is in the Christian tradition.
So are there rabbis who actually perform exorcism?
There are, yeah. They're fairly rare, right? I mean, most rabbis are not particularly concerned with ideas of possession and the Dybbuk. And this is also something that was not really a part of Judaism until about the 16th century, which was, again, that period when all over Europe everyone was getting possessed. But there are rabbis who still do exorcisms to get rid of Dybbuks. There was even one done over Skype, just like Bob Larson tried to do. And in that case, the rabbi was in Israel. He was trying to cast out a spirit for someone in Brazil over Skype, and he said, this isn't working. I got to be there in person to do a proper exorcism.
Are there cases that you have studied that you believe, based on the evidence, may actually be authentic cases of demonic possession?
Well, you know, the evidence is almost always inconclusive, right? If it weren't inconclusive, then we would have proven that spirits exist, right? And the world would be a very different place. But yes, I think most cases have things that cannot easily be explained. Of course, the famous case with Roland Doe in 1949 that The Exorcist was based on, there were reports of objects moving by themselves, scratches or even words appearing on the boy's skin. And of course, we could say that, well, you know, people were making these things up, or it didn't really happen, or the boy was doing this to himself. But that's a theory. We can't prove it. Stranger things, there was a famous case in the Philippines where a woman was hospitalized and said that a demon was attacking her. And doctors actually reported seeing bite marks with saliva appearing on her. And at one point, she lashed out at this, what appeared to be this invisible creature on top of her, and grabbed it. And when she opened her fist, there was a fistful of black fur that seemed to have come out of nowhere from her struggle with this creature. So stories like that, I simply don't know what to make of them. They're impossible stories. And we're having a debate right now in religious studies about what do we make of impossible stories like this. Do we just assume it can't be true, so it must be a hallucination? Or do we think there could actually be something there? And if there is it something we can ever know about? I think these kinds of stories should be taken very seriously.
I mentioned Dr. Richard Gallagher, who I interviewed down in New York, state-certified psychiatrist, who wrote about what he called an authentic case of demonic possession. And there was a protocol. They ruled out this patient, female patient, thoroughly examined, and they ruled out mental illness and so forth. He described to me, Dr. Gallagher, that one night he and his wife were in their home, and their cats, that were normally very, very calm animals, they started fighting at the foot of their bed and making, you've heard cats fight, it's a horrible sound. These cats were fighting, which was totally out of character. And the next day, he went to see this patient, the patient in question, and she said to Dr. Gallagher, "What did you think of the way your cats behaved last night?" Now, there was no way she could have known that. And when he told me, I mean, I could tell he was visibly, you know, upset just recounting this story. And again, it's things like that just, you know, leave me very unsettled. And it's why I certainly believe there is a very real possibility that demonic possession is a fact.
Yeah, stories like that. Of course, a skeptic would simply say, "Well, it's a coincidence," right? Which they could use on almost any sort of story like that. But it's very interesting that in many cultures, right, spirits or demons are said to have this power to know things that people couldn't otherwise know, right? So in a culture with a more friendly model of possession, it could be, you know, you get a message from the gods or the spirits about, you know, where you should go hunting this day or something like this. But in the Christian tradition, there is a long history of literature about how demons are able to do this. Saint Athanasius was one of the early desert fathers of the church. And he said, you know, it's just a trick, right? Demons are invisible and they can move faster than we can, and so they can know things. But don't be impressed if they know about how your cats are acting or something like this, right? These are all just tricks. Don't let them rattle you. Don't let them get in your head. So it's very interesting that throughout human history, we've had these same kinds of stories come up again and again.
What sort of assignments do your students get in your class about demonic possession?
Well, you know, the course is designed to have them read a wide variety of literature. So we read things from 17th century France, where an entire convent of nuns was possessed, and this went on for years. This is called the Loudun possessions. We read, of course, The Exorcist. We read translations of ancient Egyptian and Babylonian and Indian and Chinese texts. And then we read different theories of what's happening here. So we read psychiatric literature, anthropological literature, and so forth. But what I want the students to do ultimately is I want them to do a research paper. I want them to find an aspect of this topic that's interesting to them and really try to produce new information about that. So students wrote on everything from the appeal of horror movies, what makes horror movies so compelling and so popular, to the Slender Man murders attempted murder of 2014, to blues music and stories of people making deals with the devil at crossroads, to sleep paralysis, where people wake up in the middle of the night and they see things moving in their room and they can't move. So really my job is to kind of take the students' natural curiosity about the world and help them develop a better skill set for exploring it and making their own conclusions. That's what critical thinking is.
Absolutely. And now the sleep paralysis argument, in terms of an argument against, for example, the existence of what we call the old hag, which seems to be cross-cultural. People across cultures, religious groups, all report an experience with the old hag and this almost this demonic type figure, you know, sitting on someone's chest, trying to steal their breath or you know, choke them and so forth. What do you think of the sleep paralysis argument? Does it, in your mind, explain away the old hag syndrome?
Well, there's an interesting debate that people like David Hufford, who wrote a book called The Terror in the Night, have brought up. And it used to be assumed that if you grow up with stories of the old hag, then this sort of gets in your head, that it's kind of psychosomatic. So if your grandmother told you about the old hag, you'll wake up in the middle of the night and you'll have the old hag experience, and there's nothing supernatural actually going on. But David Hufford, who's a medical doctor, had this experience and he'd never heard of it. Right? And he woke up and he was certain, not that something supernatural was happening, but that someone had broken into his room and was on top of him trying to kill him. And so when the experience kind of wore off, he ran out of the room and there was a lobby or something where someone was up late reading a book, and he said, "Was somebody just here, right? There's an intruder in the house." So he said, this is not dependent on culture. Culture might help you make sense of what happens, but the actual experience is what it is. And so this is another case where I think we need to have more kind of medical doctors talking with anthropologists and people studying culture, right? Because, you know, just because the experience can be explained medically, right, they can say, well, you know, certain neurons just aren't firing because you were asleep, right? That doesn't explain why it happens, right? We still don't really know why this happens to some people and not others. So I think that we should continue to study sleep paralysis and what causes it, but we shouldn't get really smug and just say that all these stories are just reducible to a medical phenomenon and there's nothing further to think about. Closing your mind off is almost always a bad idea.
Well, you know, it's refreshing actually to hear someone who is, you know, in academics talk this way, because I get a sense that post-secondary education is not very receptive to open-minded discussions about the possibility of the existence of a spirit world. How do your colleagues in the halls of academe treat you?
Well, I'm on a philosophy department here at Texas State, and I actually have found I really like talking to philosophers, right? Because philosophy professors, they say it's great to talk about anything, right? That nothing should be off limits. So they're a really sort of open-minded bunch, and they believe that, you know, that there's a kind of intellectual richness in taking on topics that might otherwise seem weird, right? So they've actually been very supportive. And I think that there's the notion that anyone who takes ideas of possession and exorcism seriously is a fool. I think that really comes more from mainstream media than it does from actual professors. I mean, there's a few people out there like, you know, Richard Dawkins or someone who would say that this is, you know, that this belief is nonsense and needs to be stamped out. But I actually think that, you know, one of the values of the American Academy is free inquiry. So I don't think that these topics are quite as taboo as everyone thinks that they are. You just sort of have to put yourself out there a little bit and see how it plays. And in this case, the demonology class was a big success.
And the students that attend, you say that they're not necessarily skeptics. They're open-minded. Are they coming from a religious background? Are they Christian? Are they Catholic? What sort of religious training do they have?
Well, I don't ask. That's not my business to ask them, but this often comes up in class anyway. So a lot of them are, you know, their families are Southern Baptist or things like this, right? There was a Wiccan in the class who had a very different perspective on the supernatural coming out of that background. I had a student who had been a Muslim at one point and was now kind of spiritually searching other religions, and she was wonderful to have in class for her perspective on things like the jinn. So it was predominantly students from Protestant backgrounds, but there was still some nice diversity, and I think diversity is always great because you get a richer discussion talking to people from other perspectives.
Absolutely. Joseph Laycock stays with us. Possession, communion, and demon expulsion across cultures right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us.